All right, thank you. So we've heard a number of excellent talks about all stages of the Type 1a supernova event, you know, from accretion to explosion. And just to remind you that we, you know, we never see the explosion. That's taking on timescales of a few seconds. What we're seeing is this remnant of some burned material, iron group, radioactive nickel, intermediate mass elements that are expanding rapidly and are glowing for the remaining months and years. So you need to do radiative transfer calculations to calculate light curves of this remnant, and that's what I'll talk about. As we heard, all the energy for the light curve is powered by decay of radioactive nickel, decaying to cobalt and to iron. So this dashed line here is showing you the energy deposition from radioactive decay. Just follows an exponential. If the ejector were optically thin, that's what the light curve would look like, but since it's optically thick, there's some timescale for photons to diffuse out. So you see a rise to a peak in about 20 days or so, and then a decline on a similar timescale. So that's the diffusion time. And if you look at the observed supernova light curves, this is a sample of V-band curves. They're very regular, but there's you know, some diversity in peak brightness, so a magnitude difference there. Some subluminous objects are much dimmer. But then there's this important relationship that Mark Phillips pointed out, that the brighter supernova had broader light curves. And you know, this with luminosity relationship or Phillips relationship is, you know, very important for calibrating these objects for cosmology. It's very important for theory to be able to tell us what's the physics behind that relationship, what may lead to deviation from it. So I'm actually gonna focus on this in this talk. And you can think of some of the scaling. So the peak luminosity at peak is just gonna go like the mass of nickel produced, since that powers everything. So for some reason, some Type 1a explosions produce a factor of two or so more nickel than others. The width of the light curve is related to the diffusion time, which scales with the ejecta mass and the explosion energy and the opacity as well. And there have been a number of important papers by Peter Hoflik and Antoine Eastman and Paolo Mazzali, you know, modeling the light curves in the with luminosity relationship and mostly focusing on why maybe this opacity would be higher for brighter supernova. So you'll see I'm gonna focus less on the diffusion time and more on the effect of color evolution and spectroscopic evolution, so hopefully that'll become clear. The opacity in the supernova envelope is complicated because of lines, and this jagged line is the opacity from iron lines. There's literally tens of millions of lines. They're all broadened by the expansion, Doppler broadened, and they smear together to form this pseudo-continuum opacity. So basically, all the emission from the supernova is coming out of this, you know, this complex of lines. And so to model the light curves, we need to do radiative transfer calculations that include the opacity from all those millions of lines. What I'm showing is based on this time-dependent Monte Carlo code, which includes the, you know, multi-wavelength, so we calculate the spectra at every epoch. The major limitation here is that the calculations I'm gonna show you are in LTE, which is a decent approximation, but I've written the NLTE solver now, so everything I'll show you will be revisited in NLTE, but I don't expect that to really change any of the basic properties. So that's a 3D transfer code, and the idea is to calculate light curves and spectra of these detailed explosion models we've been seeing. But I want to step back and look at simpler 1D models. You can actually learn a lot from them, because at the end of the day, you just have some distribution of iron, nickel, and intermediate mass elements. And so rather than get involved in how those elements got produced, let's just take those as parameters, the mass of iron, nickel, and silicon, and then some prescription for mixing things up, you know, with a condition that they all add up to the Chandrasekhar mass. So this was the idea of Stan Woosley, and we created a large grid of these models. You may complain that these are just toy models, and they are, but the point is that you can do a detailed calculation, a very expensive calculation. At the end of the day, you get some ejecta configuration. Chances are we have a model in our grid here that essentially resembles that. And so, we can explore how the light curves depend upon, you know, nickel and mixing and all these things without adopting any specific theoretical paradigm. So it's a very useful approach. Here's an example of just one of those models, compared to observations. This model was actually a lot like W7. It had 6/10 of the solar mass of nickel and fits the light curves of the normal supernova pretty well. These are different wavelength bands, so U-band, B, VR looks pretty good. And the infrared I, J, H, and K. Fit in H and K gets a little worse, and I'm pretty sure that's due to the incompleteness of our line list at these long wavelengths. So we'll have to to work on that. But you'll notice this interesting double peak in the infrared, and the models, you know, at least qualitatively reproduce that. So what's going on with that? This plot is sort of the key to understanding that. What I've shown here is the emissivity from lines, all the lines that appear in the I band, as a function of temperature. And I put up the ionization state up here. And you'll see this large peak here in emission at 7,000 degrees, right where iron 3 transitions to iron 2. So what's going on there is that there just happens to be a large number of iron 2 lines that come in here. When I say iron 2, I mean all iron peak elements, really, you know, nickel 2, cobalt 2, iron 2. They're from excited states, so they're prominent when the temperatures are high enough to excite those states, but not so high that you ionize iron 2. And so this actually turns out to be key. If you only remember one temperature for type 1As, I think you should remember 7,000 degrees, because you'll see that so much hinges on this transition from iron 3 to iron 2. So now you look at this I-band light curve. It goes up, it comes down. The temperatures are cooling in the ejecta the whole time. And right about here, the temperature in the iron core starts reaching 7,000 degrees. All those iron lines start coming in, and you see a rebrightening in the I-band, just from the emission in the light curve. This is not an additional input of energy. This is just a color effect. More of the emission is coming out at the longer wavelengths, thanks to those iron 2 lines. And the outer layers cool first, and right about the peak, most of the iron core is now iron 2. So this light curve sort of tracing for us the temperature ionization evolution of the ejecta. And then you can do an interesting experiment. You take 6 models, and you just vary the nickel mass. That's what I've done, by a factor of 2 here. Naturally, the models with less nickel are dimmer at peak. But you notice they also have earlier secondary maxima. And so this was noted in the observations by Mario Amui, I think, over 10 years ago. And it's just nice to see that it has such a straightforward theoretical explanation. So the dimmer models are cooler, and so they reach that temperature of 7,000 degrees earlier, and those iron line emission sets in earlier. And that's really all that's going on. And it's more than just a curiosity. It's actually at the heart of what's going on with the width-luminosity relationship. So let me turn to that. This is the B-band light curves of those 6 models. Again, models with more nickel are brighter, but you can see that they're also broader. So we reproduce this Phillips relationship, classic plot here, with the y-axis is the peak magnitude in B-band. It's a measure of the rate of decline after maximum in the B-band, so delta M15. And the observations lie in this band, and you see the models reproduce the relationship pretty decently. So what's going on here? What's the why do these models behave this way? Why, you know, what's the physics behind that? And to understand it, you really have to think about how the spectrum of the supernova is evolving with time. So I've tried to illustrate this here. This is for one model. It's showing you the spectrum at maximum light in blue, and how it evolves to 20 days after maximum in red. And you see there's an overall decline in the flux level, but there's also a strong shift of the spectral energy distribution from blue wavelengths to longer wavelengths with time. And so when we're looking at a B-band light curve, we're looking in just this window here. The rate of decline depends sensitively on how quickly that spectral energy distribution is shifting out of our B-band window into longer wavelengths. And so what's the physics behind that? Again, it's iron 2 lines. So when temperature drops below 7,000 degrees after maximum light, all these iron 2 lines come in here. They blanket the B-band region, and flux is absorbed, and it reemerges out in redder infrared wavelengths, as I just talked about. And so this is, you know, a large part controlling the B-band light curve, and it's a very temperature-dependent effect. So I've tried to demonstrate that here. These are two models. The white model is twice as bright as the red model, and if you look at their spectra at maximum light, before iron 2 lines develop, they're pretty similar. The colors and spectrum are similar. But then if you go 15 days later, I hope you can see this, the iron 2 lines have developed, and then the dimmer model is cooler, and the iron 2 lines are more pronounced there. And so you can sort of read off the decline rate in B-band here. It's faster for the dimmer model, just because that color evolution is faster. Okay. So maybe this is a better way to explain it. You know, I've talked about these two relationships that the light curves obey. You know, the dimmer models have narrower B-band light curves, but they also have earlier IRR secondary maximum. They're not distinct phenomena. They're just two sides of the same coin. So if you like, the flux that you're losing here in the B-band is reappearing in greater proportion in the longer wavelengths. And again, the physics of that, repeating myself, is iron two lines coming in, redistributing the flux from B to longer wavelengths. The time scale for that to happen is the time scale for the temperature to drop below 7,000 degrees, which happens earlier in the dimmer supernova. So these are the kind of effects we need to think about to understand the width-luminosity relationship. I mean, it's worth pausing to think about how counterintuitive it might be. I mean, you're used to thinking maybe of iron as having a lot of opacity, and so if you have a lot of iron, it's going to take a long time for the photons to get out, and you have a broad light curve. But in effect, it's the opposite. I mean, iron has the effect of absorbing flux in the B and moving it to longer wavelengths. So iron makes the light curve in the B band narrower. It's a bit counterintuitive, but we have to think about the spectroscopic evolution effects to really understand what's going on. And that's really at the heart of what's going on with the width-luminosity relationship. We're really looking at differences in color evolution, which are charting the ionization evolution of the supernova. So what I just described was, you know, the correct explanation of why those six models obeyed the width-luminosity relationship. There's a second independent question of whether those models are reproducing realistically what the observations are doing. And the models are certainly imperfect, but I think you can look at the observations and see some of the same general trends in the observed behavior. So here, in this side, is observed spectra. Actually, it's a composite of many observed spectra into the SALT II templates. And they've shown here in Guy et al. Really three supernova with essentially different stretches or luminosities. I mean, I found this interesting because it's essentially happens to be the same plot that I just showed you before. So if you look at maximum light, again, iron two lines haven't developed and the spectrum is pretty much similar in all the supernova. But then if you look, this is 15 days later, there's large differences in the B band. Again, the dimmer models are more blanketed in the B band, and you can read off the decline rate. The dimmer models decline faster because of that spectroscopic effect. Essentially, a different way of looking at the same thing for people who are used to looking at plots like this. This is the B minus V color evolution with time. These happen to be the Reese et al. Templates, observational templates, so MLCS. And you see, you know, around maximum light, the colors of the supernova don't vary by that much. But as time goes on, the dimmer models evolve to the red quicker than the brighter models. These are supernova, sorry, not models. So the dimmer supernova are at the top here. So observers know this, but the physics behind it, again, is iron two lines setting in here. Once you get out here, basically all the iron core is recombined to iron two, and you reach a phase of constant color. All the supernova go to the same color grade. So, okay, I've talked a little bit about models that obey the Phillips relationship, so let me, just in the little time left, talk about some models that disobey the Phillips relationship. We have some of those as well. And so this is the effect of varying nickel, but we can vary, say, a different parameter. So this is varying the amount of intermediate mass elements, or essentially the explosion energy is the effect it has on the supernova. And you see that leads to deviation from the Phillips trend, basically because the higher explosion energy leads to shorter diffusion times, but it doesn't change the luminosity by all that much. So this is the kind of effect that could lead to dispersion from the Phillips relationship. And indeed, if it's too extreme, we get models that lie outside the observed band. So apparently nature, you know, for a given nickel mass, doesn't produce any explosion energy. It's very tightly correlated. To the extent that it's not correlated, you can get some dispersion or systematic effect. And then you'll see it more dramatically here. This is, you know, all our 130 models, where we varied almost every parameter. and you see the models lie all over the place, only a few within the observed band. On the one hand, maybe it's not surprising that we constructed these models by hand, so a lot of them don't look like things that are observed, or at least things that are very rare. Once in a while, we'll find an oddball out here. On the other hand, it is a little surprising from a theoretical point of view. I mean, we thought going in that the nickel mass would control everything, both the luminosity and the light curve width, and that's just not the case. And these are color-coded by nickel mass, so that is the dominant parameter affecting the peak brightness, but this large horizontal spread shows you that other parameters have a large effect on the width of the light curve. And so we built these models trying to understand the Phillips relationship, and we found out that the Phillips relationship was telling us a lot about the models and constraining the parameter space that was available. It's a very tight constraint, actually, and we explored the properties of the models that did obey the relationships, and we found, the constraints are roughly that the explosion energy has to be constant for any nickel mass. Maybe you burn the same amount of the star all the time, maybe you burn the whole star every time, and that's just a constant. And then also that the distribution of iron group elements, the radial distribution, has to have some regularity. I mean, we found if the iron group went out to, say, 8,000 or 9,000 kilometers per second in every model, then that was all right. But if you start mixing iron out too far, or tucking it too far in, since those iron lines are so important, that leads to large deviations. And finally, we kind of have gone far with these models, but there's a limit to what we can learn from them. If we really want to start exploring the parameter space, why certain supernova lie within the certain parameter space, we need to go to the more detailed multidimensional calculations where we put all the physics in of the burning and have some self-consistent calculations. So that's what we're doing. We're going to repeat these experiments with realistic 2D and 3D calculations. Less parameterized what I've just shown you, but still parameterized to some degree. What's interesting there is, we see that realistic explosion models may have some asymmetry. This is an off-center explosion by Thomas Lua. And we can calculate now how the light curve is going to depend on viewing angle. And there's orientation effects that'll arise if that asymmetry is large. So showing you the B-band light curve is a function of viewing angle, and both the peak magnitude and width depend somewhat on how you look at it. And the Phillips plot, it leads to some primarily dispersion in that relationship. So asymmetry is another source of scatter in that relationship. This is just one example, so we're going to now repeat this with a large number of calculations and look at all these issues in a more realistic context. So thank you very much.
We had a lot of discussions in the first few weeks of the program about rise times and whether or not that's informative. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your diversity of rise times you got for that whole spectrum of models and whether that tells you about the ejected mass? The total amount of mass.
The total amount of mass.
So let me ask the question in the pejorative sense. So, why not run a one solar? I mean, Stan knows what the question I'm going to ask because I asked it a year ago and he got upset with me. Why not run a one solar mass total model and rule it out?
Sure, we can do that. And we could run super Chandra mass. We could run super sub Chandra mass. Yeah. So that's just adding another parameter. We already saw a lot of dispersion with the Chandrasekhar mass constraint, so it'll be even larger. And in general, you expect less total mass will give you narrow light curves. And,
so is the rise time informative?
The rise time is telling you something about the diffusion time and also the distribution of nickel in the ejecta and also this effect I've shown about iron two line spinning. So all that is in there. I'm not sure if it gives you distinct information as opposed to the decline rate, but we have to look into that.
So Dan, just looking at this plot right here, it seems that what you're finding that falls in the range of observable objects is, I believe, the direction of you've completely burned the star to something, you've made some amount of nickel, but then you've burned almost all the rest of it. Is that the flavor of the way this is?
Right, yeah, so they say the constraint of constant explosion energy. So yeah, you burn some amount of nickel and then you make up for that with burning to, say, intermediate mass elements, silicon. And so you have a constant explosion energy of maybe not the whole star, but maybe you always burn 1.2 solar masses or something. And I think Paolo Mazzali had a paper where he showed from observational point of view that that the observations seem to indicate as well that you're burning a constant amount of material in every explosion.
And do the kinetic energies then make sense? I mean, in terms of what you see for the dimmest ones and their velocities, and or haven't you explored that yet?
So from the spectra, I mean, the spectra look pretty normal. As far as I know, there's no correlation between the spectral velocities and delta M15, say the minimum of the silicon velocity and delta M15. So although there are variations seen in that silicon velocity, so maybe there are a range of explosion energies, and maybe that is sort of a secondary parameter in the Phillips relationship. So that, you know, that's a motivation for observations to take objects of similar brightness with different expansion velocities and see if that is, you know, a secondary parameter in the Phillips relationship or not.
So Dan, two related questions. First, in the very subluminous objects like 91 BG, there is no second maximum. Is that just because it came in to such a short time after the first one that it effectively merged with it?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, you can see here already at 0.35, they're getting close together. And if you go to 0.1 solar masses of nickel, then the first and secondary maximum are basically coincident. So you only see one maximum.
And so then, in the O2CX-like objects where we don't see the secondary maximum either, Mark Phillips interpreted that to mean that the nickel is highly mixed throughout the ejecta. And can you qualitatively tell us why that leads to no secondary maximum, even though delta M15 isn't all that high a value?
All right, maybe I can do it. The picture like this. So if you have a stratified medium, so the iron group elements are here, you know, the temperature gradient is declining with radius. So basically, iron lines start recombining at the outer radius here and move inwards with time. So the reason that the secondary maximum is delayed is because it takes some time for this layer to cool to 7,000 degrees. But if you mix this all up, then you have iron out here that's at 7,000 degrees right at early times. So the secondary maximum happens earlier and merges with the first one. So you can imagine a recombination wave going through here. And once the recombination of iron 3 to iron 2 hits here, that's where you get the rise to secondary maximum.
Right.
And if you mix out, that'll happen much earlier.
But why is the delta M15 then not as big in those objects as it is in the 91 BG-like objects?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it may be an additional effect coming in that the expansion velocities were low, so the explosion energy was much lower than your typical supernova, and so the diffusion time was longer.
Let's have a question over here.
Yeah, Dan, this kind of goes back to Lars's question about the rise times. If you go back to the two sides of the same coin figure that you had, we know from observations that the B-band light curve, the decline rate is matched by a rise rate, and it looked like to me that the B-band on the rise side, all your different models kind of lined up. And it didn't seem to make intuitive sense to me in this monotonically decreasing temperature picture that you would get a different rise time for the different delta M15.
Right. So, okay, first of all, I've pinned all these at the same peak magnitude, and you can see that the dimmer models do have a shorter rise time than the brighter models by several days. I think it's sort of what's observed. And it's the same effect of iron 2 lines coming in earlier for the dimmer models.
I think if you make that exact plot with the data, you'll see that the spread on the, you know, on the fall side is well matched by a spread on the rise side.
I haven't. If you pin these.
No, if you normalize the time of peak and magnitude of peak, you still see that on both sides.
I think what you're saying is this is plotted since days since explosion, and are you saying if I plotted it as days since B-band maximum, you would see?
Okay.
So it would look the same way if I plotted it that way.
I think that the zero point of your B light curve is towards brighter luminosity, absolute luminosity that one would expect from the what we know about possible value of the Hubble constant and the elevation. It's really very high. It's around 0.3 brighter than what it should be for the normal ones. So it's kind of you center it over minus 19.5 instead of minus 19.2. Where most people will agree.
Yeah, so that's a good question that I really should ask observers, how well pinned down this is. And I wasn't quite sure. I've normalized this band to what I thought was reasonable. So a delta M15 of 1.1 had a peak of 19.3 something, 19.35. I don't know if, you know, so maybe this should be systematically lower and there could be some.
You can get that with, let's say, 0.6 solar masses of nickel 56. Get it up lower, the whole thing.
Yeah, so this is a model with 0.6. This is around 0.6 solar masses of nickel in here. And so it gives me a light curve of minus 19.3. I thought that was pretty typical value.
Okay, thank you. Is there one quick yes or no question? No, only if he can answer it yes or no, Al. Okay. And that's it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it starts to turn over here,
right,
you're saying?
Go. Right, it's flat.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
But this is not that small. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dan.